netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and I'm joined down the line this week by Jeff Huser. Hey, why aren't you working today? What's up?
Because I worked late last night.
You know the drill.
Yeah. It's fun to be home sometimes. I'm doing some remodeling at the house and actually seeing stuff happen instead of like the results. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, when you come home and it's too late to change anything.
Yeah, exactly. But almost done with that project, thank God.
We're here with a podcast this week, and we're talking about the Australian Film Institute Awards.
Yes, and I understand some friends of ours have come home with winners from that.
Yeah, this week those took place down in Melbourne, and they took place on, I think, Wednesday and Thursday night down there. Now, the Australian Film Institute Awards, for those of you who don't know, are, for lack of a better comparison, the Australian Oscars. Very highly prestigious awards related to the film industry down there. And we're very pleased to say that one of our FX PhD professors, Rose Draper, along with our very own Mike Seymour, won the first ever visual effects award for their work on the documentary Hunt Angels.
That's so great. I haven't met Rose yet, but I've enjoyed her Photoshop class on FX PhD quite a bit.
She's really great.
Too, right?
Yeah, she's going to teach another Photoshop class coming up. And interestingly enough, as part of the class on FX PhD, she actually showed some of the work that she had done on Hunt Angels, which I think was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, that was a great class. I was a little surprised. You know, I mean, I knew Photoshop and I enjoyed it, but it was just great to see how somebody who uses it way deeper than I do gets into it.
Yeah.
Especially with the focus on visual effects.
Exactly. And they worked on that going into the term or going into their first term here at FX PhD. And that film also actually won three AFI awards. It actually won for Best Documentary, as well as Best Cinematography in a Documentary, which is really cool. So a triple play. What's the hat trick?
Very nice.
What's the hat trick? A hat trick two,
yes,
or three?
I think that is three.
A hat trick of awards. And
me, so Mr. Sports, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm showing how much I know about the sports. We'll get some notes from our Canadian fans, I'm sure. But
so I understand you got a late night phone call from the award ceremony.
Yeah, I did actually. I just flown back in from being out of the country, and about 4 hours into sleep, wakened up from a phone call from Australia, a message left on my voicemail that they'd actually won the award. So that was a great thing to hear. I was really excited for them at that point. They actually called from backstage, which was totally cool.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you were probably so confused about time zones by that point anyway.
I had no idea where I was.
So after the excitement calmed down from the award show, Mike got back to Sydney and hooked up with Rose for a podcast to talk about this award and the film itself. So let's take a listen to that now.
So, Rose, congratulations to you.
Congratulations to you, Mike.
So, we should explain why even now, so immediately after the event, we're not actually in the same room.
Well, I think what we're sharing in common is a bit of a fuzzy headache.
We are. I had to get up at the crack of dawn and fly back from the awards ceremony to Sydney so I could go to my daughter's music recital. So I've had no sleep. And I think I'm right in saying that about 4:30 this morning when I was just about to leave to the airport, you were just getting in. But I probably shouldn't reveal too many secrets on air.
Well, you've got to have some perks on the job, don't you?
We do. And having just come back from India and literally been back, I think, 12 hours before I was in Melbourne for the awards, I was totally, as we'd say, rooted. Anyway, it's good to do this because we wanted to do something on Hunt Angels for a while. And so now is as good a time as any, I think. But we apologize to everyone listening if we're a bit hungover. So literally, last night, they gathered us in Melbourne. And do you want to tell us what happened?
Sure, we were wined and dined at a lovely hotel in Melbourne. The AFI, Australian Film Institute, is like a yearly award, and it's sort of the pinnacle of the Australian industry. And we all gathered in a huge warehouse convention centre, and it was a lovely event. So they went through a series of awards presented to technicians. Last day it was the people who actually make the film, as opposed to actors, etc. And so we went through that, and you and I were lucky enough to win our category, which was fantastic.
Now, be honest, did you think your name was going to get called?
No way! Are you joking? Did you? No,
I
bet you did.
I thought we stood a chance, but I didn't actually think we'd win. And also, I've said this before, and it's the honest truth, being nominated versus not being nominated, such a big difference. The difference between winning and not winning, while it's great to win, isn't such a big deal. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's like if you're not nominated, you're not there. If you're nominated, you're there, you have all the fun. And if you win, well, that's, you know, good. But it is, I think, first and foremost, we should acknowledge that the people in our category had done brilliant work, and it was great to be, you know, in their company.
Absolutely. And it was such a reward to even just get nominated. So that was that's such a treat. And then they called Hunt Angels, and the producer started screaming in my ear, and it was like, oh my God, that's us. It was great.
Yeah. And you know, we're sitting in the VIP section, not in the nominee section, so it was like incredibly hard for us to get out from the seats, and I think I stepped on about three people's feet getting up on the stage, but anyway. And then the thing that I found disconcerting, apart from the lights in your face, is there was that giant HD screen with our faces on it right in front of us.
Oh, I didn't even look at that. Oh, don't go there.
Spooky. Anyway, terrible. You did a very nice acceptance speech, very heartfelt, and much appreciated by the audience. And it was good, wasn't it?
It was good. It was, I just really didn't expect it, so I didn't prepare anything, but it was probably better, because I would have forgotten it anyway. So it was great. It was really nice. And then we went backstage and we had to do the photo snaps.
And we got our booty and our bling.
We got lots of bling. It was fantastic.
It was good, yes. So they looked after us very well. So a big thanks to the AFI for hosting such a great event, and also to the ABC Network, who as joint kind of producers of the program actually had been incredibly kind in flying us down to the event and looking after us and putting us up in that funky hotel. So it's nice to have film backers that are so look after their people. It was really good. Hey, let's talk about the film. Run us through the concept when you first heard about it, because you were on board before I was.
Sure. Okay, so Hunt Angels is a factual story. It's a documentary. And Alec Morgan, the director, stumbled across these two characters in the 30s and 40s in Australia who struggled against all the odds to get their stories made and up on the screen. And it was a lot harder back then than it is now to actually get films up and get them into the cinemas. So he kind of wrote a rollicking story of larrikinism, and, you know, he built these two characters. And so Hunt Angels is basically a lot of green screen. We shot actors' reenactments, and then we built scenes around them from actual archival material, so photographs and footage from the era. And it's sort of all stitched together in a very stylistic manner. So it's a really stylistic documentary, and a lot of people have trouble even defining it as a documentary. It sort of broaches on drama as well. So, it was an interesting film.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there were live actors today put into and intercut with scenes that were shot from years ago. And as you said, there were some very funny stories. I like the fact that they used to make up names for the end credits of their films, so it looked like they had a much larger cast and crew. And they were just...
It was great. And they had, you know, at one point they did a story on, I think it was on Ned Kelly or one of our Australian bushrangers. And, they had one character playing 27 different roles, and it was just that kind of, you're in a tough spot, you've got no money, so you've got to improvise. But Hunt Angels retells it with a very tongue-in-cheek approach.
And the name refers to...
I think the Hunt Angels, angels were people that backed the film. So they were people usually with their three-piece suits and their big cigars, and they were just people who weren't actually involved in making the films, but you could talk them into giving you money, and then they became your angels. And Rupe Kathner, who's the main character, spent a lot of his life hunting these angels. So that's what it's referring to.
So let's talk about some of the technical stuff, because I think it was kind of fun. I certainly got pulled in when the production was trying to solve some visual effects issues, but also just how to pull off the film, given that it wasn't a big budget. I mean, no ambitious documentary would ever have enough money any time ever. But as with all films, it was just a matter of trying to be cleverer rather than anything else. And
absolutely.
And so...
It's probably worth noting, too, that, you know, this film has such a high proportion of visual effect shots. It was just huge, and the resources were really, really tiny. So, we had to employ some interesting problem solving.
Do you want to punt at the number of visual effect shots we ended up with?
Certainly do. I counted 282. So that's quite a bit.
And the whole thing.
Yeah, that doesn't. I don't think that includes all the archive that was up-resed as well. I mean, think it was up to 500 clips. So yeah, it was just a huge.
So a lot of stuff up-resed, a lot of stuff composited, and also there was a full DI on the project to try and match all the footage in. So yeah. Let's walk through the pipeline, before we do that, I suppose we should acknowledge we had a really great DIP on this, didn't we, on set?
Yeah, Jackie Farkas was our DIP, and I spent quite a bit of time in Sydney working with Alec and Jackie very, very closely in pre-production, and that's where everything, all the kernels sort of grew. And, I spent a lot of time with them working, stitching together previs, framing shots, you know, working out actually what it was going to look like and how she was going to approach that and how she was going to shoot, and then how we would take it into, you know, our realm and follow that vision through. So that was really rewarding. Actually, it was a really rewarding creative experience. And then we shot for 5.5 weeks, I think, 5 weeks, and of that, 2.5 was green screen.
So we decided on an HD pipeline, primarily because we thought we'd get more bang for our buck, though we did do some stuff at high res and higher than HD for the stuff that we were doing zooms and stuff on. Mm. So let me walk through the pipeline, and I'll cross back to you when we... because we split the production between Sydney and Melbourne. So I was based in Sydney with a team, and you were based in Melbourne with a team. So after we obviously finished principal photography, there was the offline, and even while the offline was on, you were doing a lot of work because you were based in Melbourne right next to the offline team doing temps and stuff, weren't you?
Yeah, sure. I actually worked very closely with the editor in the early stages of the offline to walk him through how we'd visioned all the shots and how he would sort of cut them up and pull rough keys and just use the SD stuff because we edited the offline in SD. So that was interesting as well. And so we broke the pipeline up, you know, into pre-visual effects lock and post-visual effects lock. And in those first few 10 weeks or however long it was, that was when we worked on building a lot of streetscapes and doing background plates while Tony, the editor, was just working on the green screen and actually working on the story. So, yeah, that was really...
Yeah, that was one thing that we came up with that worked really well. I just insisted that we have this idea of a VFX lock, which was a point at which I said, no VFX shot will get longer. You can make them shorter, but you can't get them longer, because otherwise they wanted to keep editing to get to picture lock till much longer, and that wouldn't have given us enough time to do our shots.
Sure. And also, I think, we had that whole... trying to schedule all the shots and working out how many shots we had to deliver every week, and, you know, we had the weekly sort of number, that the target that we were aiming for, and it was a really good way of working with you, and that was, it enabled me to manage the number of shots, the sheer volume of work that we had to do, and always be on top of knowing where we're at. And,
yeah, for people that aren't so familiar with the technique, what we did is we set up all the shots, and then we, to make life simple, we assigned a letter A, B, or C to each shot, which was the level of complexity of the shot. So an A shot, I don't know if we had to define it now. It was like A was like bloody hard, and B was okay, and C was, I'm sure we can do a couple of them a day.
Yep, that's it. And in my mind, I translate that, you know, an A shot, I would regard anything that takes sort of 5 days or so. You know, a B shot could be 3 days, and a C shot would be half a day. So, yeah.
And so that meant that, because what we were really keen to do was track it from the outset, so that, because I was reporting to Sue Maslin, the producer, and what I needed to do was keep her in the loop that not only were we getting through the huge number of shots we had, but we were going to have no surprises, that we just, you know, we looked good on paper because we'd got through the easy ones and hadn't got to the hard ones yet. And so that actually gave us a good sense of what we had to pull off. And I think the other thing that did for us is gave us from almost the beginning of the offline edit, we had a sense of urgency. It didn't feel like, even though we had months to do the post, it didn't feel like it, because we knew we had to get our batting average really high to get through the shots.
Absolutely.
Which I guess is a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, it's a bad thing because it was stressful, but it was a good thing in the sense that we really did, you know, get everything into gear pretty bloody fast.
Yeah, that was a really good process for me as well, because I'm pretty organised, and that was a really nice way to just keep it in the top of my mind all the time. So, yeah, very valuable.
The other thing that was absolutely essential was to get a filing name system working, wasn't it? Because we were going to be moving stuff between Sydney and Melbourne, so if we didn't have everything totally nailed in terms of naming conventions, we would have been a complete nightmare.
So let's talk about then the what happened at Visual Effects Look, because that's particularly relevant sort of regarding the, you know, the conform between the SD and the HD.
So we took the VFX lock, and then with our visual effects editor, Nick, up here in Sydney, we broke the film apart. And so we basically did all the online assembly, brought in elements that were either film, in some cases mini DV, and archive footage, and we put together basically every shot into a folder. So we call those folders WPFs, which I can't even remember what that stood for now.
It was like, wrangled packet folders.
That's
something.
Right, because the files were wrangled at that point, and we basically wanted it so that when any visual effects artist opened up a shot, inside that folder was a quick time of what it should it look like, any notes that they needed or references to other external stuff, and then all of the various bits and pieces to pull off the shot. So you wouldn't be sitting there going, well, all right, I'm starting on a shot today. Does anyone know where these bits are? And so we wrangled those files, those WPF files, and then sent them down to, only if their shots were being done in Sydney, they stayed in Sydney, but if they were going to Melbourne, they were on Firewire down to your team in Melbourne.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was really good, because that meant that, you know, you guys did a huge job of the actual conform, you know, because I actually sat with Tony Stevens at the Melbourne end, and we went through reel by reel, and we delivered five reels to you with big gaping black holes in it and surrounding all the visual effects. And that was a really interesting process to sit through as well, with the idea that, you know, every element was on a different track. So some shots had 17 tracks. That was phenomenal.
And that was also really important that everything was done by reels, because from a logistical standpoint, you may not think it makes any difference, but even though, I guess, theoretically, because of the digital non-linear nature of what we were doing, we could have done it any which way. But by working in reels, we could conform by reels, we could solve by reels, we did everything by reels, and that made it manageable hunks. So we got reel one solved, and we didn't have to worry about everything being all over the place, and that was good. And so then we basically... Now, we had Flame up here in Sydney work on our shots, but talk to me about the Melbourne crew, because A, you had some great people in Melbourne, and B, it was a hardcore team, but with an interesting set of tools.
Yeah, sure, we did. Well, we basically work with Combustion, and that's primarily because I work on Combustion, and at the start I was the only one on board, and then we realised pretty quick that we're going to need more hands on deck. So I approached colleague of mine, James Armstrong, who's a great compositor, and he also knows Combustion. We've worked together before. So he was my main compositor. And then we also had a part-time matte painter. She was there for some of the time, Philippa Knack, and that was a real help as well, because there was so much Photoshop work involved in building these backgrounds and these environments. So, you know, a lot of groundwork went into it before we even got to the compositing stage, and she was invaluable in helping with all that sort of stuff. And then we also had Glenn Whelan helping us out. Again, he was part-time for part of the time, and he was our data wrangler, which was a huge job. That was such a huge job. And, we lost him at some stage. He couldn't stay the entire project, but God did I miss him when he went, because I had to do the data wrangling when he went, and that was huge.
That's the thing that people sort of forget is that, in fact, you know, I think when people are working on short films or commercials, they just negate and then the data wrangling is just sort of a given, it just happens, and it sort of not even much attention's paid to it. But the real secret of a film is the pipeline, and that is all about wrangling the data and moving it and getting it so that every artist that's doing a shot doesn't waste any of their day trying to find anything, and it's all there an instant, and it just happens.
Absolutely.
And you're right, Glenn did a great job. And so when a shot was at a final stage, we'd get back an FFF, which was a final something folder. And I know I invented these, but I can't remember what they were. But anyway, the FFF files would come back. And so we would get back FFF files with a unique file name. And obviously built into that was the version number and the signature of whichever artist had been on it and stuff. And then this is kind of interesting, we would take the FFF files, which were in folders, and that was parsed by an XML file handling system at this end, which would identify the file names based on the XML and the unique name we had for each file, and it would actually lift it from that. Then it would lift the XML export from the final cut edit that we had and take the new clips, the final cut edit, both in XML at this stage, and take them over to an Assimilate Scratch. And Scratch is a workflow product that runs XML. So what would happen at this point is that automatically the files would come in and be dropped into the edit. And the way that Scratch works is it's like we actually set it up in reels. It's like a flame, I guess, in a way. It's horizontal reels, but the difference is it has versioning. So every time a new shot would come in, the previous shot would be bumped up one level, or almost like put in the back layer, and at the front would be the latest version. And of course it plays 2K in real time. So we could play back a reel. So when we got new shots up, we'd run the XML parser. It would lift shots off the FireWire drive, work out where they should go in the edit, and then drop them into the edit so that we could then review with the director and in many cases with the DOP, Jackie, as well.
Yeah, that was really valuable. And so we had you guys in Sydney sort of doing, I guess it's like, you know, your reviews and your changes, etc. And that freed us up to just keep ploughing on, because that's the stage we were at. We just couldn't afford to waste a minute. So, and that was really useful, and we sort of went back and forth on FireWire drives with versions, and, you know, we were able to even grade long distance. It was fabulous.
Yeah, and then we did, with Scratch, some preliminary rough grades just to see, not to do the DI, but in fact, in this case, it was simply to see if we could, in the DI process, get the shot to be a final, or if it wasn't going to work and that we needed to revise the shot. So by having that real-time color-correcting capability, we could actually, you know, play with the shot and say, okay, well, that's got more contrast in it, and go, well, you know what? With the more contrast, the back and the foreground don't look like they're matching. We can't fix that in the DI. Before we even get to the DI, we'd send that shot back for revision out of Melbourne.
I think that was really efficient, you know. I think it would have saved, I mean, how much days would you estimate that saved?
I don't know. I mean, we spent a lot of time sitting up here doing that review process, but the point is that was dirt cheap, right? Because the Assimilate's really cost effective. We weren't sitting in a DI suite. We weren't chewing the dollars. And also the other great thing was it was really just me, the director, and as I say, Jackie. So the three of us could spend 3 hours talking about something, and it didn't actually stop us from spending 3 hours working. And then we hopefully gave you relatively concise notes on what was needed. I mean, it was, let's face it, still pretty stressful. But that it was mainly because the project was so ambitious. I don't think at that point it was stressful for the process. It was just, you know.
No, the process was great. And the stress really was just the deadlines for me. It was a huge stress, but that was really it. I mean, the rest of it, the feedback was great, and it was all straightforward and clear. And because, you know, we live in the digital age, we were able to even just send, like, you know, JPEG frame references back and forth really quickly via email. Is this what you mean? No, I mean, you know, it was visual as well as process. It was great.
Yeah, and with respect to the director, he was great, because there really was a case of saying, look, you know, I hate to break this to you, but we can't do absolutely everything we want for the budget. So let's prioritize it and work out what matters the most to you, and then we'll get those done. And then of the things that you want done, tell me what you want the most, and we'll try and get those done. And of the things that you'd just like in a perfect world, well, we may not get all of those done, but, you know, if we can, if we're revising a shot anyway, we can then make some of those other changes. And both Jackie and the director were really understanding of that, because it was, you know, classic.
It was
case,
pretty close to the wire. And we, I actually believe we got 99% of those changes done. So that was pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm sticking to that story.
No, we did. I mean, I honestly, it would have been great to have a bit more, you know, as always, like, especially...
Yeah, of course.
Some of the budgetary restraints meant that we had to be very, very tight in the DI. The DI was done by Dwayne at the lab in Sydney, and you flew up to join me for that. But were you there for the whole DI or just part of it? I think you were just there for part of it.
I think I was there for the day of the grade for the wipes and, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the other days so I think we'd been going a few days when you joined us. But I know that Jackie, who was pivotal in the grade, would have liked more time for the DI. But the reality was that, you know, I think at that stage we'd all would have liked more time. But still... You know, Dwayne did an outstanding job, and as did Will O'Connell, who was the who then took that DI, and that was obviously at a Superless Submaster, And then he helped with a bunch of last-minute revisions and minor things, which we actually did in the fire suite right next door to the 2K Da Vinci, where we were doing the DI, and also obviously titling and versioning and stuff to get the film ready, because from there it went over to AtLab for a film out.
And it's probably worth mentioning as well, you know, Jackie last night won Best Cinematographer at the AFI Awards as well, which is huge. Great.
Yeah, no, it was totally great. I mean, it was very collaborative. And, you know, with a project that's tight on budget, and there really was no concept of going back to the studio, in inverted commas, and asking for an extra million or something, that we just had to at some point say, look, given the resources we have, and, you know, I believe that a couple of things we just should take some credit for ourselves. I think one of them was actually a lot of discipline in the pipeline, because it never got out of control, and it was pretty, even though it was a bit, you know, sort of fascist groove thing at times, because we were so anal about naming conventions, but having a lot of automated technology and also just the discipline of not having all the visual effects artists stopping work for lots of reviews, and I'm sure that was hard on them not to be present for all their reviews and just have to take notes. But I think all of that just meant that we just maxed out and got as much bang for our buck as we could.
Absolutely. And it's a body of work to be proud of. It's just enormous. And I think it's a huge achievement to get that much work in such a short time frame with so few resources up on the screen. It's great. It feels great.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm desperately in need of another couple of lattes. And
I was going to suggest a Bloody Mary. Maybe that's just hair of the dog stuff.
Yeah. No, I don't want to admit to chronic alcoholism on air. But it was so brilliant to be standing beside you on the platform last night, and it was a great project. I loved working with you.
Yeah, it was wonderful, and thanks so much, Mike. I've really enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure.
And thank you so much for joining us over on our sister site with FX PhD. And some of your shots from Hunt Angels you've actually used in your PhD Photoshop lectures, haven't you?
I certainly have. I've used two or three, I think, where we just break them down and rebuild them, and I can, you know, reveal the process involved. So, yeah, it's been great.
I think it's also good because I think some people were surprised that you were using combustion. I mean, obviously, I was using flame in Sydney, and that's no bloody surprise if you know me. But honestly, I don't think we would have been able to do it if you'd been on flame, because we wouldn't have been able to budgetarily justify. So combustion was a really key tool there. And,
absolutely. We also used After Effects for a couple of the shots there, but mostly we relied on combustion. Absolutely.
And that's great to see. Look, again, I'm going to let you go and have some sleep, and I know I'm going to go and have some intravenously applied caffeine.
Yes, fair enough. Well deserved.
All right. Well, congratulations again.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Thanks for talking to us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. And, of course, as Mike mentioned, he was wiped from traveling down to Melbourne, because we've actually been traveling together for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, what was that itinerary? You guys were a little bit of everywhere.
Yeah, we were started out in Germany, down to the south of France, a little bit in Madrid, visiting some people at a facility called Telson in Madrid, heading over to the UK and London and Oxford, and then off to India for a whopping, less than 48 hours, but it was a great trip.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And what we're doing is we were traveling around Europe, and we figured it was a good opportunity. Mike was presenting at a conference in London, and we thought it was a good opportunity to visit all the 3D tracking software developers, because Science D Visions, makers of 3D Equalizer, are in Dortmund, Germany. RealViz is located in the south of France. Pixel Farm and 2D3 are, of course, located in and around London. And we're basically getting material and information for our background fundamentals class in Term 3 at FX PhD. In addition to finding out a little bit about the Indian market, as well as promoting the FX PhD site there. So it was a great
trip.
We learned a ton. It was really, really fantastic that we could meet face-to-face with the developers of the software. We really had amazing access to that.
That's great. And Term 3 starts soon, right?
Yeah, Term 3 classes are going to actually start on December 18th. It's going to be the first week of classes. So if people are interested in that, we've got a great After Effects course that's taught by Mark Christensen. You may recognize his name from the It's After Effects Studio Techniques, I think, is the name of the book. But he's a really great compositor, as well as a well-known After Effects guru. And so he's going to be leading our intermediate After Effects class this term. We've got a Final Cut Pro class now, a new Final Cut Pro class, which is pretty exciting, a Luster class, as well as a ton more stuff as well on the site. Be sure to check it out at fxphd.com. It's not too late to sign up.
Can you explain the preview system to people listening who may not be familiar with it? I mean, I think that that's a really interesting thing that you can actually check out some classes.
Yeah, what happens is once you sign up, you don't really have to pick your classes for the first several weeks of the term. What we do is we allow you to audit, effectively, all the classes. So before you pick and your choice is locked in, you actually get to see the first two classes in each and every course that we offer at FXPhD before locking in your final classes you're going to take. So it's a great opportunity if you're kind of hesitant, should I take the Luster class? Should I take the After Effects class? That kind of gives you an opportunity to see what the class is going to be out and decide if you want to take one.
I think that's a nice feature.
And that's,
yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, that's been, we tried that out last term and people really dug that a lot. And so we'll continue doing that this term.
That's great. And am I right? There's an option now to take an additional course?
Yeah, if you want, we have the option to take an extra class for an additional fee. We personally feel that the number of classes, the three elective classes plus background fundamentals, is more than enough, especially for those of you with full-time jobs, because we actually have a lot of full-time artists who are members on our site. But for those of you who don't have a full-time job right now, you definitely have the option of taking extra class this term, which a lot of people have gravitated to as well. So
yeah,
you can pick a class based upon your workload, actually.
Yeah, I would actually caution people to, you know, use that carefully and make sure you can do it, because I mean, I do work with several people who have signed up for the classes, and you know, you do get overwhelmed after a while. It sounds like, oh, 2 hours a week of video, that's great, but you know, it's a lot of material, and then by the time you follow through exercises and try stuff, and it's a commitment. So that extra class is adding extra workload. So if you've got the time and you've got the capability, it's great. I think it's great to have that option for people, but the classes do take some focus. It's great.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, really, I've been trying to audit almost all the classes, and it's overwhelming how much stuff there is.
Yeah.
And information. It's just great.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Great response. We met up with a lot of students as well on our trip through Europe, so including great pub night there in London, which was a lot of fun. So really looking forward to term number 3 at FXPhD, and we'll have more information about that on FX Guide and both FXPhD in the coming weeks, so everyone can have some time to check it out. So
that's great.
Yeah,
I thought I was lucky. I got to go to Epcot with Mike. You got the real experience.
It was fun. You know, our business partner was just happy that we didn't end up at blows and fighting with each other by the end of spending almost 20 days together. And
yes, traveling with someone is always interesting.
Yeah, but it was a blast. We had a great time, and like I say, learned a lot that we'll be passing on in term 3.
Yeah, saw some pictures. It looks like it was a good time. Got to see some students, and it's cool.
Yep, it sure was. Well, hey, you know what? Congratulations again to Rose Draper and Mike Seymours, as well as everyone involved in the production of Hunt Angels.
Wonder when we're going to see that over here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll try and figure that out. Maybe we can get Mike to point on that in the online story that's going to accompany this. So.
Yeah, hopefully it'll at least be on DVD. If it doesn't, I'm sure it'll be released at some point.
Yeah, I'd really love to see it. I think it'd be a lot of fun because I've certainly heard a lot about it during the production of it. So
cool.
Well, that's it for this week at Effects Guide. I'm John Montgomery.
I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening. Glad I could join you today.
Yeah, me too. Good talking to you, Jeff. Hang in there.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.